potential.
It ignited a different type of creativity to how they're going to win the game.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Peter Frankopan is a historian who likes to take on big ideas, sweeping across many centuries and national boundaries. In his acclaimed book, The Silk Roads, A New History of the World, published in 2015, he argued that the Persian Empire gave rise to the West, and he explored the importance of the trading routes that linked Arabia and Asia to Europe, and how they spread ideas, culture, and religion. The book was a bestseller in the UK, China, and India, and even inspired a musical collaboration between the singer Katie Mellor and students at Oxford, where Peter is Professor of Global History. His follow-up, The New Silk Roads, The Future and Present of the World, investigated how economic power is shifting eastwards. More recently, Peter has turned his attention to climate change. In The Earth Transformed, he examined how it has dramatically shaped the development and the demise of civilizations across time. Peter, we're going to hear works by Tchaikovsky and Mozart, but we're going to start with a piece by Edward Naylor, which I think you sang as a chorister at Westminster Cathedral.
I did. Well, I'm pinching myself that I'm here. I mean, when I'd started my undergraduate studies and my PhD, I never thought I would end up talking about my musical choices on Private Passions. So it's such a privilege. But yes, when I was a little boy, I was a chorister at Westminster Cathedral.
Yes.
And I loved being a chorister. But the reason I chose this piece is that when I was a young chorister, we'd walk down to the music schools. We'd have a choir practice before breakfast or first thing in the morning. And there would be flutters of excitement from the elder boys when the piece that they loved was on the music hall set out for them. And when you go in first time and you hear that noise, you wonder what it is that's making them so excited. And Vox Decentis by Naylor, it's a kind of quite a rambling Edwardian specialty, but it was one of my favourite things to sing. But every time I listen to it, it reminds me of the privilege of being in a choir where we were trained so well. And Stephen Clebury, my choir master, as he was just, he taught me, I think, about how to be accurate, how to be specific, and how to work in a team. And all of those things turn out to be quite useful if you go into a career in academia.
Well, let's listen to Vox Decentis by Edward Naylor, and we're going to join the music towards the end of the piece.
Thank you.
Vox Decentis by Edward Naylor, performed by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, conducted by the late and much lamented Sir Stephen Clebury.
Just listening to that sends the hairs on the back of my neck up, and it was just such a fantastic musical training that I'm so grateful for myself.
Do you think also, it's certainly what I think from my time at Westminster Cathedral, that it teaches one a certain confidence because you are doing a professional job at a very young age?
I didn't realise that at the time. I thought it was completely normal to be at school until 5 o'clock on Christmas Day. It turns out that that wasn't the case. But amongst the things that we learnt was that if you made a mistake, you put your hand up. And as long as you did, you'd carry on rehearsing. And it was recognising when you'd made a mistake and that the problem wasn't making a mistake. It wasn't either admitting it or realising. So I think there was something very important in training at that level.
You had a particularly poignant memory of making a mistake, I think, with Stephen.
Well, he would point at us with no notice, more or less, to do the solos. And my first ever solo was in Cologne Cathedral when we were on tour, I think in 1980, where I sang the Benedictus and the Bird four-part Mass. And, you know, the elation of getting to the end without messing it up was great. But the second time was to do the intro of a plainsong chant, and I fluffed it and promptly burst into tears, probably before I'd even finished making a mistake. And he called me to come and see him afterwards, and I burst into tears again. And he asked me why I was crying, and I said, well, I made a mistake. And he went, that's the way you learn how to not make mistakes. You can't be perfect all the time. And it's such a profound thing in a world today where particularly young people feel they've got to be perfect with their GCSE grades, you know, what they're going to do in their lives and careers. And, you know, I said, well, you're never going to choose me again to do a solo. And he was a very kind man. He said, of course I will. And he did that with all of us. He was very good at picking us up and giving us a bit of responsibility. And, you know, I suspect no one would ever remember the mistake. Probably no one ever heard it. But to me, it felt brutal.
But you've immortalised it now.
I know. It's never to be forgotten.
Your mum, Ingrid Detter, is a Swedish scholar of international law. And your dad came from a leading Croatian aristocratic family.
So my mother's family is Swedish. She came to Oxford to do a DPhil when she was very young. My father's family comes from Dalmatia in Croatia. It's from a very distinguished old family that, like a lot of East and Central Europe, was traumatised by both the First World War and then the Second World War that produced large numbers of refugees. And my father's family sent him to England when he was a boy. So he last saw his parents when he was 12 years old. He came to a boarding school in England. And that connection that my family had with Dalmatia and Croatia, which had a long history going back 1,000 years, was more or less cut by being deracinated. The arrival of communism in Eastern and Central Europe made posh families not wanted people, but difficult to survive. And in fact, in a funny way, it was also a blessing, because what my father taught us was first that whatever you achieve can be taken away from you very quickly, but also that it's not enough to reflect on what it is that your ancestors did decades and hundreds of years ago. You need to go and earn a living and work hard for yourself and earn your place in the queue. And when I first went to Croatia, as it became in 1989, it was kind of amazing seeing where my family had been buried, where they'd lived. And it was a kind of, I guess, a choice that we had, which was either to get more involved in that part of the world, particularly as Croatia became independent in 91, it declared independent, became recognised in 92. And since then, we've spent quite a lot of time in Croatia, got lots of land there that we have to keep an eye on. And those restitutions are difficult, working out that you can't just take everything back or that you want to take everything back. That part of the world has been one where history has shifted repeatedly because Yugoslavia, communism, Austria, Hungary, for the last 400 or 500 years, Croatia hasn't really had an independent past. But now, since the war ended in 95, the present and the future look slightly different.
What about the musical legacy? You played quite a few instruments when you were young.
Yeah, we were encouraged to be musical, I think partly as a discipline, but also because of a love of music. My mother in particular was good like that. So I started playing the cello when I was small, but then I moved school and it was too big to take on a bus, so I switched to the violin, which I didn't particularly like. So I was allowed to take the flute up, which I also didn't particularly like because it's a little bit harder than it looks. And I kept saying I wanted to play the oboe. And an oboist called Keith Marshall took me under his wing. And like everything, if you find the right instrument at the right age, you fly.
And one of the reasons for choosing the oboe was this piece, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Mozart is the, you know, you can begin and start an entire musical life only listening to Mozart. And I'd heard this piece when I was 7 or 8 years old. And as I've got older, I've realised that putting together a piece for 13 wind instruments is unusual. Not many composers do that. But the opening of the Adagio, where you hear the oboe floating at the top, that has been always in my mind when I was a boy and ever since, of the inspiration to play the oboe. And in fact, the oboe is just one of these ensemble instruments, but the opening few bars take you into a kind of ethereal place. And in fact, you can hear the fingering as the oboe comes down. You can hear where the forked F is if you've played the oboe. So oboists out there, I'm sure, will recognise that too. I mean, it's perfection, isn't it?
I could see you going into almost dreamland.
Well, you as a composer, Michael, tell me, how does one do that? How does one create from nothing something that feels like a insight into heaven?
I think it's to do with less is more, quite often. The space between notes and the effortlessness of if you are a genius like Mozart.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is you have kind of almost visual flashpoints too about where you've heard pieces, what you were thinking, what they did or inspired in you.
We heard the Adagio from Mozart's Serenade in B-flat for 13 wind instruments, the Grand Partita. It was the Academy of St Martin in the Fields wind ensemble conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. How do you think your interest in maps and the layout of the world, both geographically and politically, came about?
Well, I start the Silk Road, and I say I had a map on my bedroom wall, and like lots of people, I love staring at maps. You know that maps mislead you because all they mark the Himalayas, you don't get any sense of what they look like or how big they are. But I think it was seeing these parts of the world that I never heard of before and memorising capital cities and the great rivers and mountain systems. And I was a child of the Cold War, and when I would come home and watch John Craven's News Round, it was quite obvious that the things we were learning about at school, and in fact even the music that we listened to, comes from a very small corner of the world. And thinking, even as an 8 or 9 year old boy, everything that seems to be happening in the world seems to be happening in geographies that are not connected to what I'm learning in the classroom. And I think that that set me off on a journey of looking particularly eastwards, east of the Berlin Wall, right the way through to the Pacific coast, was something that I really wanted to understand, why the Soviet Union wanted to kill us all, or potentially kill us all. Why was it that there was such anger and hostility of different populations in the Middle East? Why was the Shah so unpopular? And why was it in central London that there was a hostage siege in 1979? And I think the map played a kind of catalyst role in disconnecting education and curiosity. And there's no harm in trying to go and explore yourself and not wait for your teachers to tell you what to study, but to go and read and learn and think.
And did this geographic curiosity extend to music?
Certainly when I would travel to go and visit new countries, the first thing I did, and still the first thing I do, is I ask the taxi driver to turn up the music and, you know, ideally play a local radio station. And so I've always tried to search out what local musical traditions are and to see that as an important part of thinking about the history, actually. So history is not just about past events. It's also about what people wore, what do they eat, how do they celebrate, what kind of instruments did they have. And Central Asia in particular is extremely rich in the forms of experimentation, but also in the way in which traditions are handed on. And those are often oral traditions. Nomadic peoples don't write their histories in the same way, and as a result have by and large either been written out of history or been characterised as violent or chaotic. And I think it's really important to be inclusive in how we think about the past, partly because the great cities and great empires in history have always been stimulated by interactions with nomadic peoples.
Well, you were living for a while with nomadic people in Central Asia, weren't you? And that's probably what inspired this next piece.
Evenings in Central Asia are always enriched by people getting out their instruments or singing. We probably don't quite do the same in Oxford. We tend to have evensong that takes 40 minutes, people looking at their watch, and then it's high table and conversation. And I love the musical traditions of celebrating the arrival of guests and of showing culture to outsiders. And the hospitality of many of the peoples of Central Asia is legendary, unless you're trying to attack them, in which case they're less friendly.
Well, tell me about this piece, Kyrgyz, music performed on a kind of harp.
The ensemble Tengirtu, it's the Kyrgyz name for often called the Tian Shan Mountains, the Chinese name meaning celestial mountains or heavenly mountains. And if you are living in Kyrgyzstan, the mountains play a fundamental part of your visual identity every day. And it's interesting, I think we in the European tradition, we see mountains and think we should climb them and remember who climbed them first. And many other cultures venerate their mountains as sacred objects, sometimes even sacred beings. Tengirtu, which means the celestial mountains, is a very prominent Kyrgyz group that play a whole set of different traditional instruments, and it's really important that these traditions are kept alive. So Jangilik is one of the pieces that has made the group famous.
Jangilik means novelty.
Yes, it's a modern interpretation of Kyrgyz music, but I suspect that these are not so dissimilar to what you'd have heard 1,000 years ago too. Thank you.
an extraordinary sound.
Well, it's the harmonics. I mean, and it's partly to do with the way in which indigenous and nomadic peoples use everything that they can find. And so every part of an animal, every part of your landscape, you have to interact with because resources are scarce. And so that's where nomadic peoples all over the world have used things like sheep's bladders to play musical instruments. You know, you find a use for everything. You know, small bones and things that can be used to create musical sounds, gut that can be used to create stringed instruments. It speaks of an engagement, I think, with natural resources that we find slightly unusual here because we don't think about where our things come from.
Peter, you've written two books about the Silk Roads, trading routes that stretched from north-central China to Constantinople or modern-day Istanbul, and they would have passed through southern Kyrgyzstan, where the music we just heard is from. What was it about those particular routes that so interested you?
Well, the Silk Road, it's a complex term, and it's quite a contested one, exactly what it means, because there isn't a road or series of roads. But in scholarship, going back to China and Central Asia, the concept of roads that connect people together is a really important visual and literary metaphor to explain these links. And I understand and interpret the idea of Silk Roads as just a set of different connections, but it's the ways in which peoples, goods, ideas, foods, fashions, you name it, connect people together. And in fact, most of the time when we think about long-distance travel, it's about elite goods. It's about silk or gold or turquoise, the things that are rare, and therefore they get noted and get written about. But most people's interactions in these regions is local. People don't tend to move a long way away from home. But the concept, I think, around nomadic peoples is having to be sensitive to local environments and also to work out their identities. Often these nomadic confederations can blossom where lots of people can be brought under the leadership of a single group or a single leader or a single tribe, and they can also melt away very quickly. And it's an intriguing, I think, way of trying to think about history, which is how do these empires form, how do they fall away, and how do they interact with sedentary peoples, people living in cities who are doing the writing of the histories and are often quite misleading.
And that's made us look, as I think you argue we should, much more at places like Turkey and Iran.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are 1,000 students in the UK at universities studying combined Russian, Arabic, Turkish, Korean, Japanese, Chinese, Thai, Khmer. And learning a language is one way to understand a people's culture, but music is another one. Understanding their food, their fashions, their histories, their poets, their artists is really important. So, I mean, during lockdown, I did a couple of competitions that I helped set up with schools in Britain for young people, so under 13, under 16, under 18, to say, you know, if 1066 is the seminal moment in British history, which, you know, please don't send me emails to say, I'll give you alternatives. But, you know, what is the equivalent in other people's histories? And, you know, I said, you can pick whichever country you like, but, you know, there'll be bonus points if you pick somewhere outside Europe. And I think that kind of idea about what is it that really matters if you are growing up in China and which part of China, would you give a different answer? But also none of these other parts of the world. I think it's important to be reading up about other people, because other people have spent a long time working out who we are, watching Wimbledon and the Ashes and wondering what that's all about, understanding our pageantry and the way we do things. And we haven't done the same in studying other people's histories.
You were talking about the passing on of traditions orally. And our next composer, Hungarian, great composer Bartok, his music is inflected by Hungarian folk song, which indeed he collected. And this piece that we're going to hear, which in fact was his last, is particularly colourful and wonderful, summing up, I think, of his feelings about his country.
Well, you should tell us about that, Michael. You know this piece much better than I do, so it's a sort of lucky happenstance that that's the case. But I mean, Bartok, as a Central European emigre living in New York, engaging in the middle of the 20th century with change and experimental forms, the idea of concerto orchestra is obviously itself sort of quite playful. But it's a very complicated piece, the concerto. It's almost five different orchestral pieces on their own. They don't necessarily relate to each other.
I think this concerto for orchestra, written as Bartok was actually dying of leukemia, but the ideas that he got in his hospital bed were so exciting that he just had to get out and write them down.
Yes, and you'll hear my beloved oboe prominently again here, but it's the conversation between the orchestra is a really interesting one. And, you know, it's written just before the creation of the United Nations. And one could read this, I suppose, as a global community of instruments within the orchestra having these conversations into a world order that then emerged. And that's probably, I mean, I don't know whether that's how he'd have seen it, I very much doubt it. But I think because it's written in 1944, in this dark moment in global history, but with an idea that once the war had ended, there needed to be a way in which we would stop ourselves ever leading into such hours of darkness again, of the Holocaust, the sufferings all over the world. And there's something quite hopeful, I think, about this piece.
Wonderful music, and I love the way he has the mastery of the control of his material, to play games. So one minute you've got that very moving romantic folk melody, and everything is derived from those notes. And then you've got blowing a raspberry at Shostakovich on the brass.
I mean, it's amazing in 4.5 minutes to be able to fit so much in. I mean, just fantastic.
That was the Allegretto from the Concerto for Orchestra by Béla Bartók, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. Would you say that in your work you've become more interested on the whole in periods of prosperity than wars when looking back at time?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I hunt down wars. I mean, I suppose on the bottom line, I'm interested in what works. And I'm interested in exchange. I suppose that's what I describe myself as, historian of exchange. And those cultural exchanges, the ways in which religions have borrowed and competed and jostled and fought each other, are very interesting. The ways in which goods and ideas and peoples have moved around. So exchange is what I'm interested in. And I suppose war is a breakdown of those mechanisms. Warfare as an offensive method is about expansion. Normally, the creation of empires is about the expansion of ecological, environmental boundaries. I mean, you expand your empire so you can gather materials, resources from other parts of the world, ideally at the cheapest possible price, and bring them back to the centre. And of course, that's the point of the transatlantic empires that Britain built, with tobacco and sugar and cotton, and coerced labour and slavery to make these resources at the highest possible profit margin. But all empires do something similar. You know, the Romans' expansion into Egypt or into the Middle East was highly selective in trying to pick off targets and resources that would be valuable. So I suppose war is interesting in the sense that it shows dislocation and it shows ambition to try to exploit. But I am particularly interested in why things are stable. And the Byzantines, for example, for 1,000 years had more or less no inflation. Very good system of social mobility, so families tend not to stay in power at elite level for very long. There's a constant recycling of positions and resources. And some of those empires that are quite good at being efficient, like the Byzantines, like the Mongols and the Ottomans, my three favourite examples, are the ones that probably have the three worst reputations in Western historiography. You know, the Byzantines are seen as over-elaborate and chaotic, but they managed to work things out for 1,000 years with different climatic zones, different religions, different languages. And that stability, I think, is extremely interesting, particularly in a world where the way we think about history in the West is one battle to the next, partly because between 1350 and 1950, there wasn't a decade that didn't involve a war between European powers, often in other parts of the world. But, you know, our continent in Europe is extremely unstable for all sorts of reasons, and that's not absolutely what things look like in other parts of the world.
You mentioned earlier how music can trigger synapses, and I think there's a very pleasant trigger to this one, which is it reminds you of your wife.
Well, I fell in love with Russia when I was a teenage boy, and discovering Russian theatre, literature, art, politics, history was topped by music, and Tchaikovsky can do no wrong in my mind. But listening to Romeo and Juliet when I was a teenager, I thought, well, that's what love must sound like. You know, the calling of the French horns, yearning. And, you know, when you're a teenage boy, you think you'll probably never find the right person. And I was very fortunate that I met Jessica, my wife, when we were undergraduates at the same college. And it's what my relationship has felt like. And after more than 3 decades together, that idea of a couple calling for each other and wanting to be in each other's company, and the romance of the 19th century in Russia, has always been something that has appealed to me.
Music from the Fantasy Overture, Romeo and Juliet by Tchaikovsky, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic and conducted by Lauren Marzell. Your latest book, Peter Frankopan, is a global history of how climate has shaped the history of the world, looking at the big events that have had most impact. You also touch fascinatingly on religion and how religion offers explanations or attempts to offer explanations about the natural world.
Well, I think a lot of the world's religions in their earliest form are about equating good moral behaviour and benign conditions. I suppose that's the story of the Garden of Eden, the expulsion of Adam and Eve for disobeying God and eating from the fruit of the forbidden tree results in humans having to scrabble in the dust and in the weeds and the thistles to find their food and to work hard. And in the Quranic tradition too, the harmony of God and the warnings that humans must behave properly and morally, otherwise there'll be punishments, we find echoes in all sorts of belief systems. One of the important parts of the mandate of heaven, which is a sort of part of the imperial ideology in many Chinese dynasties, is that a good leader and a good ruler and a good person can be shown by the fact that there are the right levels of rainfall, not too much, not too little. And equally, when those things go wrong, there's obviously bad behaviour and immorality that's being punished from the heavens. I suppose, understandably, because that's where the baking sun is located and the rains come from. So there is a kind of logic to trying to provide explanations and to encourage humans to live in ways that are sustainable, kind, and not selfish. That's a hugely important part, I think, of our common human tradition.
I loved the details of Thomas Jefferson's obsession with climate.
Interestingly, the founding fathers or the early settlers in the United States were convinced that human activities were changing the climate, and in particular because of deforestation, that this was making North America colder. And Jefferson got into a few rows about that because, as you'd entirely expect, academics rounded on him and said, it's all anecdotal. You need to have evidence to show that it's colder. It's not enough just to talk to old men and old women who say it used to be warmer. So Jefferson used to take temperature readings every day. In fact, on the morning of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson went to Sparhawks in Philadelphia to go and buy himself a new thermometer to have more accurate readings. And he took these readings every day for decades. In fact, he went back the next day after America declared independence from Great Britain to go and buy a barometer so he could measure whether there was change because of anthropogenic and human activities.
You also look at the ways new research and technology are transforming how historians consider the past. I mean, fossilised pollen, tooth enamel, bubbles trapped in ice, clamshells in Peru, cherry blossom.
All of those are amazing, and many more too. Genomics, the ways in which we can deconstruct the phylogenetic tree of pathogens and diseases. It tells us so much more about the past. It opens up a whole new set of avenues. And I think that's a real challenge, actually, because historians, we tend to have gone down a humanities track. And actually now working with the sciences, plant sciences, biological sciences, earth sciences and so on, is hugely important because of the volume of material that's coming up. And evidence helps build the case. It doesn't necessarily always transform and overturn everything we've been thinking about. But a lot of these materials are giving us, almost like in The Wizard of Oz, where the transition goes from black and white into colour, a whole new dimension of how we can think about the past. In fact, just this morning I've been reading a new paper about the genetic makeup of the Tajik populations and the relationships to Xinjiang provinces in China, what's now China, and to Bactria, so ancient populations of Central Asia 2,000 years ago. And from looking at these skeletal remains and looking at humans today, we can see how people are moving, how far, how many. Are men moving or is it women? And those kinds of things mean we don't just have to rely on guesswork and we don't have to rely on sources that can be misleading. But those new materials are completely transformation. They're mind-blowing.
Vivaldi next.
Well, Vivaldi is the doyen of Venice, and Venice has a important place in my heart as a city. I used to love listening to the Four Seasons. It was one of the first things I listened to as a boy. I came late to Nisi Dominus, which is an incredibly haunting, wonderful piece of music. And in fact, I watched Narcos over lockdown, this amazing Netflix series about drug cartels. And I've always listened to Nisi Dominus, I've always thought of it as a good piece to listen to when you're contemplating trying to solve problems. And there's a scene in Narcos Mexico where the drug kingpin, Don Felix, has everything closing in on him and this music is played. And Nisi Dominus I still play when I'm slightly anxious about things and trying to work out what I should do next.
One never minds hearing the voice of Andreas Scholl.
The countertenor voice. is an extraordinary thing. When you hear it and hear a world-class countertenor, you know, you realise that we are blessed with extraordinary capabilities as a species.
Nisi Dominus by Vivaldi, with the countertenor Andreas Scholl and the Australian Brandenburg Ensemble, conducted by Paul Dyer. It's virtually time to say goodbye, but nice that we're going to, as it were, end at the beginning, because this is a piece of choral music, Ubi Caritas by Durufle. So your love of that thing with which you began in music takes us right through to the end, doesn't it?
Well, I guess, as you say, it goes back to the beginning, but it's a reinterpretation of plain song, gorgeously done, and I suppose that's what historians are all trying to do. We're trying to reinterpret. I mean, we do occasionally find amazing new breakthroughs and discoveries, but we're trying to find the old and make it more relevant, and Durufle does that incredibly well in this particular one of his four motets. But it's also a beautiful hymn in its own right. You know, where there is charity, there is God. And I think that that idea about kindness and philanthropy and generosity, they're easy to forget in the busyness of life and in the noise of getting from A to B or trying to do one's own thing. It's about how one puts other people first, how one always thinks about what other people might need. And again, because it speaks back to, well, the plain song that I fluffed at Westminster Cathedral a long time ago.
The DNA of your musical
life. It's always
life.
There. I think it's hard not to feel uplifted. So on a difficult day when things haven't gone quite well, it's to remember that God is always there and there's charity that encourages us all to think about kindness to other people. And, you know, I was very lucky to be brought up as a Catholic and to have performed in these great cathedrals. And any time I'm feeling wounded or difficult or exposed, which, you know, can happen when you write books that are very visible, Ubi Caritas can just remind you that there is a context for all of this. There is a backstop and, you know, Deus ibi est.
Peter Frankopan, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ubi Caritas by Durufle, performed by the Choir of Trinity College, Cambridge, conducted by Richard Marlowe. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the historian Peter Frankopan. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the writer and film producer Olivia Harrison, the widow of the Beatle George Harrison. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, has said it would be irresponsible to keep spending money on the HS2 high-speed rail line. Mr Shapps, who was the Transport Secretary from 2019 to last year, said the pandemic, the invasion of Ukraine and inflation have led to unprecedented costs. The government has said it's committed to the project but has refused to confirm whether the Birmingham to Manchester leg of the route will be built. BBC News understands a decision will be made this week. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has ordered a review of armed policing after a number of Metropolitan Police officers stepped back from firearm duties. It's in response to a marksman being charged with the murder of Chris Cabba in South London last year. Ms Braverman said officers should not fear ending up in the dock after having to make split-second decisions. Armed officers from other forces are being deployed in London. Sir Ed Davey says the Liberal Democrats are considering scrapping some of their house-building targets because the current approach is leading to the wrong houses being built in the wrong places. The party had pledged to build 380,000 homes each year if they came into power, but it's expected that will be abolished tomorrow at the party's annual conference in Bournemouth. Sir Ed insisted the Lib Dems would maintain a target of 150,000 social houses. Kosovo's Prime Minister says at least 30 gunmen have been surrounded by security forces in the majority ethnic Serb north of his country after a deadly attack overnight. A policeman was killed and at least one other was wounded. Albin Kurti called it a terrorist attack carried out by masked professionals and has accused Serbia of backing the ambush. Belgrade has denied similar allegations in the past. NASA is awaiting a delivery of asteroid dust, which could reveal new details about how the planets were formed. A probe was released from a spacecraft earlier and will land in the US state of Utah this afternoon. The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft left Earth in 2016 to investigate the Bennu asteroid, which has a very slight chance of hitting our planet late next century. The Rugby World Cup in France, Scotland and Wales are back-to-back in action later today. Scotland will play Tonga in Pool B and Wales are top of Pool C. And the weather, it'll be a cloudy and windy afternoon with outbreaks of rain in the north and west. It'll be drier and brighter to the south and east. And that's the BBC News. It's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music. Experience the best concerts from across the UK and Europe, night after night.
Welcome to City Halls in Glasgow.
Welcome to Belfast.
With works from the biggest names in classical music, performed by world-class musicians.
The Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra.
The Royal Concertgebouw Orchestras.
Experience the music and the atmosphere. Radio 3 in concert,